From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because life and truth matter. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast, we present an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast in which Hank talked with Francis Beckwith, professor of philosophy and church-state studies at Baylor University. Here now is Hank Hanegraaff.
And welcome to another episode of Hank Unplugged. This is, well, it is the podcast, not the broadcast. It is what takes me out of the studio and right into the study. This is not as didactic, I suppose, leaning forward as it is conversational, and I'm really excited about podcasting. I didn't even know what podcasting was a couple of months ago. I certainly know what it is today, but today I have a guy I want you to meet, someone that many people in the intellectual community are very familiar with. And I suppose people around the world are familiar with him in general. But there are probably a few people listening in like flies on the wall who don't know who Francis Beckwith is. And if you're one of those people, I want to introduce him as a philosopher who publishes and teaches in the area of politics, jurisprudence, religion, and ethics. He's a professor of philosophy and church-state studies, and he's the co-director of a program in philosophical studies of religion in the Institute for Studies of Religion at Baylor University. By the way, one of my kids went to Baylor University. Most of you listening in that know anything about me know I have 12 kids, a lot of them in university at the same time, but one of them was a student of philosophy at Baylor University, my namesake, Hank Jr. Frank, of course, is a prolific author, and most recently he wrote a book called Taking Rights Seriously, Law, Politics, and the Reasonableness of Faith. This was a Cambridge University Press imprint, and I think it won the American Academy of Religion's 2016 Book Award for Excellence in the Study of Religion in the category of Constructive Reflective Studies. If that's not enough for you, way back in 1993, and this was the occasion for me to really get to know Frank Beckwith, he wrote a book called Politically Correct Death, Answering the Arguments for Abortion Rights. And I remember back in those years, I would go through that book and then through it again and then through it again. I dog-eared that book. I quoted from that book. That book was transformational because in that book, I started understanding how significant the life issue really is. Francis Schaeffer once said that this would be the watershed issue of our epoch of time, and he was certainly right about that. I'm talking to Frank as well because both of us made some significant changes in our lives, but we are both deeply committed to the concept of mere Christianity. Frank, I am so delighted to catch up with you. It's been a long time. We haven't talked. Got a letter from you when I converted to Orthodoxy, and it was very, very calming to me. You said, I've been through this. If you want to talk, let's have a conversation.
Well, it's great to be on, Hank. I can testify that I remember when you interviewed me for Politically Correct Death, and we were in the studio together, and I couldn't believe the color coordination that was in the text from notes you had taken and things you wanted to memorize. So I can testify you did, if it were a record album, we could say you bled it white, right?
Exactly. I mean, I love that book. And of course, you've written many books on the life issue. I mean, this is one of the issues that is a passion for you. Maybe we should start out by talking about this rudimentary issue. Here we live in an age of technology. When you wrote that book, we didn't have the kind of technology that we have today. I mean, people can now examine the evidence and know that a preborn child can actually see the face of a mother and have the cognitive awareness of whether that face is upside down or right side up. So we have great strides in technology, but the abortion issue isn't going away.
Yeah, it's really the watershed issue of our age. I mean, there are many other issues that I think one can link to the abortion issue because they all deal with, to a certain extent, the question of who and what we are and whether we can know it. And the abortion issue raises even a deeper question, and that is, what sort of obligations that we do we have to those that are more vulnerable than us that we bring into existence? I mean, there's something godlike in the fact that human beings can actually, with God, participate in bringing other human beings into existence. And the idea that we can simply destroy those human beings as a matter of will without any justification is abhorrent. And it was that issue really profoundly affected my own sort of development as a Christian in the early 1980s. I was considered myself moderately pro-choice around 1984 or so, when I was in graduate school, and one of my fellow graduate students, who, believe it or not, was an atheist, shot down my pro-choice arguments. And it really it surprised me how badly I was reasoning. And the other thing that was ironic about it is it was an unbeliever that actually was the one that helped change my mind. But as I began thinking more deeply about the issue, I began to see how it is connected to not only, you know, a sort of obligation we have just to not harm others, but the obligation we have for those that we actually are responsible for bringing into existence, and what that tells us about just ethics in general. Many of the ways in which people reason about this issue always emphasize the struggle and the challenges that a pregnant woman may have. But if you think about it, the idea that our ethics should be driven solely by what we perceive as consequences for ourselves is, I think, ultimately undermining the kind of obligations that do require us to, in fact, move above and beyond what our desires are. I mean, this is what it means to be human.
You know, I think about the experiences I've had, Frank. You know, as you know, I have 12 children. And watching children being birthed is one of the greatest wonders imaginable. To see one human being come out of another human being is truly a miracle. I always watched it without any sense of the blood or the gore that some people get turned off by. It was always a beautiful mystery that was unfolding before my eyes. And, you know, the more you see births take place, the more you know about what happens before a baby is born, the more passion you have about subjects like this.
Yeah, and the today, as you mentioned earlier, the technology, when we were able to peer into the womb and see things that even people 25, 30 years ago would have never thought imaginable. And yet, the idea that abortion is permissible still persists, and I think it has a lot to do with how people think of their own nature as human persons. Usually, when we think about human beings, we think about usually ordinary adult human beings, and those are individuals that have consciousness, are able to reflect on life, and a lot of people. Some people, some philosophers will say, well, the unborn aren't like that, so therefore they're not truly persons. And I think it's a mistaken view of what we are. We're not at any one point of our existence wholly or completely perfected. I mean, so if you think about the human being not as at any one point being complete, you can see that what the unborn human being is just simply one of us at an earlier stage of development, and that the maturation of that being is in fact a movement towards its perfection, but it still is what it is. It doesn't become anything different. It's just simply, in a way, it's a kind of unfolding, right, of the majesty of the image of God that is that we reflect. And yet, you know, it still persists. The good thing is that I think that in terms of the general culture, people are much more inclined to the pro-life position than they were maybe 25, 30 years ago. And I think the technology, the technological advances, I think have made that possible.
What about the anthropological problems that persist, though? I mean, if you look today at things that concern you, like gender fluidity or same-sex sexuality, all of these things are part and parcel of a misunderstanding or a misappreciation of the Imago Dei, the image of God in humanity, and how we were created to be by an infinite, ineffable God who is knowable through his graces.
I think you're right. I mean, it's of the same kind of thinking. And let me explain what I mean by that. People today have a kind of dualist view of the human person. Now, I want to be careful here because as Christians, we believe that in fact we have souls, and those souls can exist apart from our bodies. So I do believe that as Christians, we accept a kind of dualism in the sense that we believe that there's an immaterial aspect of our nature that does survive death. However, another important aspect of the Christian worldview is that we're going to be resurrected. Why? Because we are embodied souls by nature. We're not simply souls that happen to be tagged onto a body. Well, what does it have to do with abortion and gender issues? Well, insofar as those that want to sort of separate the intellectual part of the person from the physical part of the person can actually say things like, well, I feel like a woman trapped in a man's body. The assumption is that there is a physical kind of, that the human body is a kind of instrument of the mind and is not the real self, but the real self is purely the psychological. And tie that to the abortion issue, because the early fetus and embryo isn't psychologically mature, the assumption is it's not truly a person. So you have there's similar reasoning there. And I think the thing that has to be, I think, argued for is that human beings are not simply, our psychological selves. That is certainly an important aspect of us. It's the way we exercise our will. It's the way in which we think. But if we're ultimately, though, embodied, think about it. Even when we think, we have to actually perceive the world that's out there. We are beings that eat and drink and feel and love with our bodies. This is what we are. And so this is why, as Christians, we have to, I think, remember what the scriptures teach and then what the tradition teaches, namely that we're not simply this kind of Cartesian view of a thinking thing that happens to be attached to some bit of matter, that we are ensouled, and that what we are as human beings is something that is complex, but it's also reflects the way in which God has made us, and he made us not simply as minds attached to bodies, but in fact embodied souls.
I want to go back a lot of years in time with you right now, Frank. When I hear you talk, I can almost hear Bob and Gretchen Passantino. They had a great impact on your life, just as they had a great impact on my life. I remember when I became president of the Christian Research Institute, I didn't have the acumen that I needed, but there was a man and woman in the background, solely hidden from view, to the largest degree, mentoring me, slowly teaching me. And that was something that absolutely radically changed the trajectory of my life and ministry, and I think we have that in common.
Yeah, I met Bob and Gretchen, 26 years ago, this past April. And for those who have never met the Pasadenas, a lot of people haven't, because as you said, they were sort of behind the scenes. But I'll never forget the time, the first time I went there to their home, which was this building adjacent to a Lutheran church in Newport, Costa Mesa area. And you've been there, the huge library of books. I remember I walked in. I knocked on the door, and Gretchen answered with this big smile on her face, and she dressed like a hippie right out of Central Casting.
That's right.
And she gave me a big hug and told Bob, Frank Beckwith is here, and proceeded to yell it to her son Paul to clean up and get ready for dinner.
Don't go away. In just a few moments, we'll rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Professor Francis Beckwith. If God is good and all-powerful, why doesn't he put a stop to the evil in this world? Christians and non-Christians alike struggle with the concept of a loving God who allows widespread suffering in this life and never-ending punishment in hell. In the book, Why Does God Allow Evil?, Clay Jones examines what Scripture truly says about the nature of evil and why God allows it. Grasping the truth on this issue will change your view of God forever. Receive your copy of Why Does God Allow Evil as our thanks for your gift. Simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. Stay tuned. We'll be back shortly with more this special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching design with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. Here's what's in the latest issue of the Christian Research Journal. Hank Hanegraaff explains that while politically correct culture is quick to point out discrimination and abuse of women in other respects, there has been a deafening silence when it comes to the systematic oppression of women under Islamic Sharia law. Other topics include God made us so that he could be our father in a way that reflects his fatherly relationship to his only son, the rational inescapability of God. Was there a Jewish temple in ancient Jerusalem? And much more. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today by calling 888-7000-CRI or subscribe online at equip.org.
To fully grasp the significance of Christ's messianic role, you must drink deeply from the wellspring of Old Testament prophecy. In Hebrews, as in the rest of the New Testament, the Old Testament history of Israel is interpreted as a succession of types that find ultimate fulfillment in the birth, death, resurrection, and ascension of the Christ we celebrate at Christmas.
Hank Hanegraaff has penned The Heart of Christmas, a devotional for the season to ensure that just as you prepare your home for Christmas, you likewise prepare your heart. Order The Heart of Christmas, a devotional for the season by calling 888-7000-274 or by going online to www.equip.org. This then is the climax of divine revelation, God with us. The infinite has progressively revealed himself in accordance with our finitude. Thus, prior to Emmanuel, general and special revelation revealed his glory. But in the incarnation, we have seen his glory. Thus writes Hank Hanegraaff in his book, Incarnation, the Ultimate Self-Revelation of God. In short, God's incarnation in human flesh is the apex of revelation, his last word. In taking on human flesh, God gives us more than the clearest image of who he is. He gives us himself. To receive your copy of Incarnation as our appreciation for your financial partnership, simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches, or visit equip.org. Equip.org. On this special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff, we're bringing to you an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast, in which Hank talked with Francis Beckwith, professor of philosophy and church-state studies at Baylor University. Let's now rejoin Hank Hanegraaff and Professor Beckwith in their conversation.
I met Bob and Gretchen 26 years ago, but I'll never forget the first time I went there to their home, which was this building adjacent to a Lutheran church in Newport, Costa Mesa area, and they had, you've been there, the huge library of books. I remember I walked in, and I knocked on the door, and Gretchen answered with this big smile on her face, and she dressed like a hippie right out of Central Casting.
That's right.
And she gave me a big hug and told Bob, Frank Beckwith is here, and proceeded to yell it to her son Paul to clean up and get ready for dinner. And then I just remember walking in and seeing the rows of overstuffed bookshelves. And I was there, I think, till 2 a.m., arguing with Bob and Gretchen and sometimes agreeing with them about a variety of theological issues. And the thing that I think really stood out about them was you never got the impression, even if you disagreed with them, that that made any difference. They sort of enjoyed the whole aspect of learning together. The character of, and I think of Bob Hastino, I think of Joe Pesci character in My Cousin Vinny. You know, so if you can imagine. So that was what, so, you know, for those out there listening, this is the way it was. I mean, they were the brightest people I knew. And they had at that time no other than undergraduate education, everything that they were self-taught, but they were so well-read, so well-informed. And because they were so well-read and so well-informed, there was a kind of built-in humility to the way in which they conducted their lives. Even when they felt very strongly about something, they knew enough that they realized that even people who they thought were wrong may have a point. And so there was a wonderful aspect of visiting them. When my wife and I lived in Southern California, we spent many Sunday afternoons at their home, and it was a place. It was almost like like Boys Town. People were visiting there all day long, and Gretchen was cooking, and it was wonderful.
And you had to dodge the dogs. And, you know, the toughest thing for me was getting out of there. I mean, I remember the long hours. You know, you have these conversations, they go on and on and on and on. They were very stimulating. But I'd look at my watch and think, I've got something I got to do early in the morning, and it's 1 o'clock. I got to get out of here. And so you try to make your exit. Bob Passantino, he would walk you to the car.
Yeah.
And then he'd be talking to you, the car window still rolled up. He's still talking to you. Well, you don't want to be rude, so you roll down the car window, and he's talking to you. Then you start leaving. You start driving away very, very slowly, and Bob is keeping up with you as you're driving away. I mean, it was hilarious. But this was, I mean, this is a real expression from my perspective of authentic Christianity, because they had a passion for apologetics. They had a passion for always being ready to give an answer to anyone. And so they saw people who had platforms, people like you, people like me, and many, many others. I mean, the tribe can be multiplied many times over, but they saw people that had platforms, and they knew that by investing in those people, they were laying up for themselves treasures in heaven, where moth and rust do not corrupt and where thieves do not break in and steal.
Yeah, they were amazing. I think about the times, and I'm sure you've had this too. I would call up Gretchen and I'd say, you know, I have a question about something. I want to get your opinion. And then I hear her after about 10 minutes, she goes, Bob, get on the other line. And Bob would get on the other line, and he would once in a while interrupt in that Bob-like voice. He would say, wait, let me just say this. He would talk like this. And he would, and Gretchen would say, "Be quiet, Frank's speaking." And it was just, we'd be on the phone for sometimes 2 or 3 hours. But yeah, and I would sometimes get calls from Bob at all hours of the night, you know, just because I just had this idea. One of the, it's amazing. They were an amazing couple, and I miss them dearly.
You know what's cool about all of this is that they were lifelong learners, and I think that is one of the values they instilled in me. Obviously, what I do as president of the Christian Research Institute and host of a daily Bible Answer Man broadcast is I have to be a lifelong learner, can never be static. And they instilled that value in me, continuously wanting to learn to become a sharper tool in the hands of the Holy Spirit. And I suppose if there's a message that we want to get out to people listening into this conversation, it is be a lifelong learner. And I bring this up, Frank, I suppose, because this in some way has to do with my conversion to Orthodoxy and your return to Catholicism. And I suppose maybe as prelude to that, we need to talk about what mere Christianity is, because one of the interesting things that happened when I converted to Orthodoxy after attending an Orthodox church for almost 3 years was that I immediately lost a lot of listenership, reason being I lost between 100 and 150 radio stations. Almost immediately, of course, other doors have opened up, and so the ministry continues on as before. But a letter from NRB Television President Troy Miller, for example, said, "Dear Hank, it has been brought to our attention through a number of our viewers, external media, and your program that you have converted to Eastern Orthodoxy. It has affected your public ministry and negatively affected our viewership." So as a result of my conversion, there was a slamming of doors all over the world. And I think that if you are a lifelong learner, oftentimes you are not willing to stay pat. And I say that maybe even in light of the fact that Gretchen Pasentino died in 2014. I spoke at her funeral. And Bob died before that, and you recognize the brevity of life. And so ultimately, what you do is for an audience of one.
Yeah. Yeah, the whole idea of lifelong learning, it's something that, you know, the thing, being around them and seeing the way in which they just consumed so much literature. But the thing about it, though, is that they didn't read and they didn't learn just to argue for their own positions. I mean, that's certainly not wrong to do that. You want to learn how to defend your faith, but they also read in order for their own sort of intellectual and spiritual development, wherever that may lead. In fact, I guess I can share this now. Soon after I returned to the Catholic Church, Gretchen sent me an email, and I was blown away by it because we had never talked about Catholicism or anything of that sort. But she told me that her and Bob frequently would talk to they talked to each other about me and my wife, and one of the things that Bob apparently said to Gretchen was, "I wonder how long it's going to take for Frank to become Catholic." And this is what she said. This is the email. "Many years ago, Bob and I thought you would really enjoy the worship experience of Catholicism, and we were encouraged when you were attending that Anglican church in Newport Beach. I know he's pleased for you as well." Of course, he had since passed away when she wrote that. But the thing that the Pasentinos instilled in me is the same as your experience. And as I've gotten older, I realize how much I don't know. Still, I was telling a couple of my students several months ago, I wish I was as sure of myself now as I was when I was 35. I think as you, as a lifelong learner, you begin to realize that, you know, that you, there's a limit. You can only read and do so much, and you have to do your best and pray, and but you can't, you know, there's a wide world out there of knowledge, and you can't know it all.
What is that quote? The larger the island of knowledge, the greater the shoreline of wonder, or the longer the shoreline of wonder. It's exactly what you just said, Frank. I mean, the more you know, the more you realize how little you know in the scope of what could be known. And I think to some degree that that puts a big precedent for all of us, or at least should, in my estimation, on the historicity of the church. We ought to take seriously the communal or the collective memory of the church. I mean, not just as we talk about church fathers, but the grannies that passed on information to grannies to grannies. That has some significance. If you have, for example, a view, as Catholics do and as Orthodox do, in the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist, and that view goes on through Luther, it seems to me you have to take that seriously.
I think you do. I think the other aspect of that historical continuity, and this is something as a Christian public intellectual, I think I feel liberated when I became Catholic in this sense. I no longer felt that I had to that I had to always have the meter running. And what I mean by that is that I'm part of a grand tradition. And that if I died tomorrow, the church would go on well without me. But when I was a leader in the evangelical world, I kind of felt I was really important. And I don't feel as important now. And it's great because I'm not part. It's just not me. It's and a few people. It's I'm part of something that's bigger than myself, and it's a lot larger in. As G.K. Chesterton said, it's a lot larger when you're. It's a lot bigger when you're inside than when you're looking from the outside in. So, being part of that kind of is liberating. That doesn't mean you don't care about defending the faith or making a case for Christianity, but it's. But that's not the entirety of your life. It's you have to. You're permitted to, participate in the larger life of the church without always worrying about, the next article that's going to come out. So at least for me, I mean, everyone's different, but my own experience, I found it liberating that there isn't that sort of pressure.
I remember when I was 14 years old, and you made me think of this as you're talking, I was... we had immigrated to the United States, first to Canada, the United States, from Holland. And my parents and my sister and myself at that time were going back to Holland for a trip. And we stopped in London. And I'll never forget, as a 14-year-old boy, standing in St. Paul's Cathedral and thinking about the immensity of church history. I mean, I was looking up at a dome that I could barely see. It was so far away. It was so majestic. It was so grand. I was thinking about the relics that are built into the altars and the ossuaries and the tombs. And when you're in a church like that, you get a sense of history. And I think what you were communicating, our smallness in perspective of the grand panoply of history.
That's right.
We'll pick up Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Professor Francis Beckwith in just a few moments. The Bible Answer Man broadcast and CRI's growing array of outreaches have never been more needed than they are today. And that's why we won't be shy in asking you to stand shoulder to shoulder with the Christian Research Institute through your persistent prayers and generous financial support. Stand with Hank Hanegraaff and CRI in the battle for life and truth, and receive your copy of Why Does God Allow Evil as our thanks for your gift. Simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org.
We'll be back after this quick break with more of the Hank Unplugged podcast interview with Professor Francis Beckwith on this special edition of the Bible Answer Man. An infinite God reduced to the size of a human embryo, the creator of time and space, invading both in human form? Such is the mystery and the majesty of the Incarnation, supreme being condescending to become one of us. Perhaps nothing is more important than grasping the significance of the coming God in human flesh. Without the life, death, and resurrection of the incarnate one who walked among us, our world would be unfathomably dark. To be equipped as a witness and to be inspired in your walk, you'll want to feast on Hank Hanegraaff's book, Incarnation, the Ultimate Self-Revelation of God. To receive your copy of Incarnation, simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches, or visit equip.org. Equip.org. Angel said to them, "Do not be afraid. I bring you good news of great joy that will be for all the people. Today, in the town of David, a Savior has been born to you. He is Christ the Lord. This will be a sign to you. You will find a baby wrapped in cloths and lying in a manger." Luke chapter 2, verses 10 through 12. While many of you will soon enter the hustle and bustle of the holiday season, Hank Hanegraaff has penned The Heart of Christmas, a devotional for the season to ensure that just as you prepare your home for Christmas, you likewise prepare your heart. Order The Heart of Christmas, a devotional for the season by calling 888-7000-274 or by going online to www.equip.org. Also available is The Heart of Christmas audiobook, dramatically read by Hank Hanegraaff. The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching design with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. Here's what's in the latest issue of the Christian Research Journal. For many Christians, the reality of God is so obvious and undeniable that we're amazed anyone could seriously doubt it. And yet, many do. How can we help such people recognize what seems to be so apparent to us? James N. Anderson highlights six aspects of everyone's life that can be explained only if God exists. Other topics include, was there a Jewish temple in ancient Jerusalem? The irony of 13 reasons why, and much more. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today by calling 888-7000-CRI or subscribe online at equip.org. Welcome back to a special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. If God is good and all-powerful, why doesn't he put a stop to the evil and suffering in this world? It turns out the real problem isn't with God, but with us. Don't miss Clay Jones' surprising and compelling approach to what is perhaps the greatest challenge to the Christian worldview. Receive your copy of Why Does God Allow Evil as our thanks for your gift. Simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. Let's now rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Professor of Philosophy, Francis Beckwith.
Now, I'll never forget as a 14-year-old boy standing in St. Paul's Cathedral. And when you're in a church like that, you get a sense of history. And I think what you were communicating, our smallness in perspective of the grand panoply of history.
That's right. And it makes one less concerned about the present. And I want to make sure this doesn't come across as we shouldn't care about the present. Obviously, we should. And we have many obligations as Christians to advance the common good and so forth. But what I'm saying is that when we look at what's happening in the world or things that may be happening in our respective churches that we don't like, there's a better historical perspective that we get when we see ourselves as just one part of a long narrative that's going to have a future and that's already has had a past, rather than seeing that we have to reinvent the wheel every generation. I think that puts a different perspective on the calamities of our age. Again, I don't want to diminish the importance of an active Christianity in the present. I certainly have done a lot of that myself, but what I'm suggesting is that it puts a perspective historically on our present age that we don't know what the world's going to be like 100 years from now. And think of so many of the things that are occurring today. We mentioned abortion already and transgender theory. Those sorts of beliefs that are in the public square didn't arise out of nothing. They arose from a cluster of ideas that were probably hundreds of years old, and now we're seeing them come to fruition. We don't know what role we're playing as Christians in terms of advancing the faith that may, we may be planting seeds that 100 years from now flourish in a way that is glorious and something that we would never have anticipated, but we don't know. And so I think looking at the history of the church in that way, we're less upset about the present.
I want to talk for just a few moments about what many evangelicals think of when they think of the Church of Rome. I remember many times while Chuck Colson was alive and he was working on ECT with Richard John Newhouse, and he would call me sometimes on the weekend, and he had really stepped in it, and the evangelicals were very, very upset because he wanted to work with Catholics on common cause issues, and this became a great stir. And so he'd call me and we kind of talk it out. Of course, with Chuck, he was a little different. And he'd always call me, Frank, and then he'd ask me a question, he'd answer the question, he'd ask me another question, he'd answer the question, he'd ask me one more question, he'd answer the question. That would go on for a while, and then he'd thank me for really clearing up his mind. Chuck was a hoot, but he was he's a true Christian statesman. But, you know, it gave me a sense of some of the vitriol that can come out when you mention Roman Catholicism. In fact, I want to read you something and have you comment. This is something that I wrote in my book, The Apocalypse Code. This was while Tim LaHaye was alive. He, of course, had indicated that he studied biblical prophecy for more than 50 years. And as such, he was absolutely certain that the mother of prostitutes and the abominations of the earth, covered with blasphemous names, is none other than the Roman Catholic Church of the 21st century. The Church of Rome, he said, is doctrinally a mixture of Babylonian paganism and Christianity, a far cry from the faith once for all entrusted to the saints. And then he went on to incriminate the Roman Catholic Church in the most pejorative terms imaginable: pseudo-Christian, false religion, mother of idolatry, Nimrod. And in his view, Rome is not the only form of Babylonian mysticism, but merely the one that has infiltrated Christianity. And after the rapture, their leaders, the leaders that remain, will bring all the Babylonian-based religions together with one global idolatrous religion. Now, when you read that in popular literature, and I've heard Tim LaHaye say this when he was alive, and I've heard many other evangelicals quote things that are very similar about Roman Catholicism. Now you have someone like Frank Beckwith who returns to Roman Catholicism. You were the president of ETS, and you can imagine the thoughts in the minds of many people that are listening to this kind of rhetoric.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness, it is happening before our very eyes.
Yeah. I got a lot of emails about that. In fact, my wife, I don't know how this person got my wife's email, but wrote my wife and said that you and your husband have joined the Whore of Babylon. And I had to tell my wife was so upset, and I said, don't respond. So she did it. I think Tim LaHaye in many ways was a good guy. I you know, I think I admired his courage for his stance on a lot of the cultural issues, but like many people in evangelicalism, he was deeply influenced by a book that had come out in the 1960s or 70s. It may be older, but that's when I bought it. It was called Babylon Mystery Religion.
Yeah.
It was it became a kind of bestseller in the evangelical world, and the thesis was is that Catholicism, Roman Catholicism, is a sort of combination of Christianity and the appropriation of Babylonian religious practices. And the book is, I mean, it's historically awful. I mean, it's not accurate. The practices that are singled out are actually practices that are found in Eastern Orthodoxy, the view of the Eucharist, the understanding of liturgy, and so forth. And what the author of the book, I think, doesn't understand is that these practices are very deep in Christian history. Robert Wilkin at University of Virginia published a book several years ago about the early Christian church, and this is actually something that really influenced my return to Catholicism. The thing that Wilkin argues in the book is that if you go back to the very earliest liturgies that we have records of in the second century, you have things like prayers to the saints and a practice of the Eucharist that clearly implies a kind of Eucharistic realism. And this is found not only in the West, but also in the Eastern churches as well. And so, yeah, I mean, I think you have folks like LaHaye who are, I think, well-meaning Christians trying to persuade people to come to Christ. But I think at the end of the day, they don't have a very good sense of Christian history, and they just believed these books.
You know what I like about the way you answer that question and the way you're dialoguing with me on that particular issue is I don't hear the vitriol in return. It's not as though, well, this guy is the worst person that ever walked the face of the earth because he said that particular thing about the Roman Catholic Church. Instead, what you're doing is you're highlighting the positive aspects of his life and the contribution that he made while he was still living. And I think to some degree, all of that is very, very necessary in answer to the Lord's high priestly prayer that we all may be as one, not one in the sense of compromising what C.S. Lewis called mere Christianity or an essentials unity, non-essentials liberty, all things charity, but one standing shoulder to shoulder in the battle for life and truth, not finding ways to bifurcate or trifurcate, but rather finding ways by which we can find commonality so that together we can have an impact, particularly in this epoch of time when unity among Christians is desperately needed.
That's right. And I think having been on both sides has been really helpful to me. As somebody that has written things critical of other faiths, both as an evangelical and a Catholic, and getting to know people on both sides, and I think also just the maturity that comes with age, the thing that you begin to realize is that in some ways you kind of admire people that sort of stand up for their beliefs. So Tim LaHaye wrote those things, and they're kind of nasty, to be sure. But in a way, I kind of would rather live in a world where people actually take theology seriously, and they're able to make these distinctions. So LaHaye, I mean, for all the rhetoric against Catholicism that you read from that work, he worked closely with Catholics in Washington, D.C. for the cause of the pro-life position. So, you know, I think the fact that people take theology seriously, I think is a good thing. And in fact, people are complicated. They can exhibit certain virtues in terms of the way in which they conduct their lives, but they may not actually exhibit intellectual virtues in some areas. This is just the way that we are as human beings. So, but I do think you're right. I mean, we have to learn how to work together. especially since we share so much in terms of our moral beliefs, our views about the family, our views about the relationship between the church and the wider culture. These are things that Christians virtually all share, and if we don't if we don't stand together, they'll hang us separately, right?
Yeah, one of the things though that a lot of evangelicals would tell you is a deal breaker is, and that's both for you and me, is that we've both bought into systems of belief that are crass systems of work righteousness, and therefore we're giving up an essential to historic Christian faith. Think that through with me.
Yeah, I think one of the misunderstandings I think that a lot of Protestants have about Catholic and Orthodox views of grace is that they have I think this is maybe it's not the best way to explain it, but they have a kind of zero-sum game view of how human beings and God work together for our own sanctification. So for them, it's like it's either grace or me. But the Catholic, and correct me if I don't want to misrepresent the Orthodox view, but they're very similar in this sense that grace plays a role in healing the soul, which has a particular nature, and that the soul has a will. And so when we exercise our will as a consequence of God's grace working through us, in a mysterious way, it's us acting, but God gets all the credit. And because God is all-powerful, and he's also not a thing in the universe in the sense that, you know, it's either God acting or us acting. It's a cooperation, but yet it's still him.
Well, we've run out of time for today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. To listen to this Hank Unplugged podcast interview with Professor of Philosophy Francis Beckwith in its entirety, go to equip.org, iTunes, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. If you'd like to stand shoulder to shoulder with Hank Hanegraaff and the Christian Research Institute in the battle for life and truth and receive as our thanks for your gift the book Why Does God Allow Evil, or any of the other resources mentioned on the broadcast today, just call our resource consultants now at 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org. You can also write to us at CRI P.O. Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina 28271. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded solely by listeners like you. We're on the air because life and truth matter. To fully grasp the significance of Christ's messianic role, you must drink deeply from the wellspring of Old Testament prophecy. In Hebrews, as in the rest of the New Testament, the Old Testament history of Israel is interpreted as a succession of types that find ultimate fulfillment in the birth, death, resurrection, and ascension of the Christ we celebrate at Christmas. Hank Hanegraaff has penned The Heart of Christmas, a devotional for the season to ensure that just as you prepare your home for Christmas, you likewise prepare your heart. Order The Heart of Christmas, a devotional for the season by calling 888-7000-274 or by going online to www.equip.org. This then is the climax of divine revelation, God with us. The infinite has progressively revealed himself in accordance with our finitude. Thus, prior to Emmanuel, general and special revelation revealed his glory. But in the incarnation, we have seen his glory. Thus writes Hank Hanegraaff in his book, Incarnation, the Ultimate Self-Revelation of God. In short, God's incarnation in human flesh is the apex of revelation, his last word. In taking on human flesh, God gives us more than the clearest image of who he is,
He gives us Himself. To receive your copy of Incarnation as our appreciation for your financial partnership, simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches, or visit equip.org. Equip.org.